Her verse is praised for its stark, vivid imagery, subtle rhythms, and spare language, which distills images and thoughts into concise expression. She described her work as condensery, and several critics have compared her poetry to the delicate yet concrete verse of Chinese and Japanese writers. Although her long correspondence with Louis Zukovsky and contact with such respected writers as Sid Corman and Basil Bunting brought her some critical notice, her work was generally overlooked until late in her life. Since her death in 1970, she has been recognized as a significant and original voice in contemporary American poetry. If Wisconsin-born Laureen Nitecker was one of the great original voices among 20th century American poets, why did she remain obscure for most of her life? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
How did living in rural Wisconsin affect Nitecker's literary reputation? How did she fare in the fast-paced New York literary circles of the 1920s and 30s? And just what was her contribution to American poetry? Our guest is Margot Peters, author of Laureen Nitecker, A Poet's Life, published in 2011 by the University of Wisconsin Press.
Well, welcome to University of the Year.
Thank you very much, Emily and Norman.
Well, let me ask you, if you're in an elevator with someone and they see that you've got this new book on Laureen Nitecker and they say, who is that? How do you answer by the time the elevator opens?
I answer that she is probably the most interesting woman poet that the United States has ever produced.
That's quite hyperbolic. The most interesting woman poet.
Could be a long elevator conversation.
Even more interesting than Emily Dickinson?
It could. Yes, I know I was going to get that question from you. Even more interesting than Emily Dickinson. Laureen herself didn't think that she was as daring as Emily Dickinson had been for her period in the 19th century. I'm quoting Basil Bunting, a British poet, probably not very well known here. He found her the most interesting poet. And remember, he's speaking in 1970. There have been many fine poets since, fine women poets. But I find her probably the most interesting, yes.
And what led you to embark on this biography of her? What about her poetry and her life drew you to her story?
Well, I was eating lunch in the Portobello in 1985 and discussing my latest biography with a friend about Mrs. Patrick Campbell, the British actress. And suddenly a figure appeared next to my booth at the Portobello and said, why are you wasting your time on Mrs. Patrick Campbell? Why aren't you writing about Laureen Nitecker? And I did say, Laureen who? At that point, I had no idea who she was. So after that lunch, I went over to the university bookstore and looked for her poetry. I found The Granite Pail that had just been published. Took it home, read it, and was very struck by her as a poet, and then kept reading her. But I was doing other biographies, and do you want to hear how this really happened, this biography?
Oh, yes.
I went to a play about Laureen at the Horde Museum. I think it must have been 2008 or 7. And when I left, there was a woman staffing a desk with Laureen materials on it. And I said rather breezily, oh, I've always wanted to do a biography of Laureen Nitecker. So I went home and thought nothing of it. And the next day I got a call, and it was the president of the Friends of Laureen Nitecker, Ann Engelman. And she said, we have a biographer. I'm absolutely thrilled. I've heard that you are going to do the biography. And I said, could you give me a day to decide? And then I called back and I said, yes, I would be glad to. But I think I'd meant, yes, if I'd been 20 years younger or if I if I weren't involved in all the other things I'm involved in. So I dropped everything and went after Laureen. And what a fascinating subject.
Where did you start?
I started first with people who were still living that knew her, because those people, my experience is that they start popping off the minute you're trying to write a biography. They instantly die on you. I remember writing some actress who had acted with the Barrymores, and when I got to her apartment, they were kind of literally clearing out the coffin and her belongings. So I started with those people, got to them first, and then started with the archives at the Hoard Museum and at the Dwight Foster Public Library in Fort Atkinson. Both places have collections of Loreen Niedecker material.
And how important do you think her Wisconsin roots are to the kind of poet she became?
I think that they are important, but Loreen Niedecker, and I hope this isn't off-putting to anyone, was also an intellectual. She lived a great deal through books. She read widely. She read philosophy. She read Greek and Latin writers. She read Chinese poets, Japanese poets. She read Thomas Jefferson. She read Darwin. She was so not limited, really, mentally by living in Wisconsin. There's an episode I talk about in the biography, and she sends her book to the Milwaukee Public Library to be put on the shelves and learns later on that she's been filed under regional, and she's very angry about that. She says, what region? You know, what region do I belong to?
Well, literally speaking, she was born on or near Black Hawk Island in southeastern Wisconsin.
Absolutely.
Near Fort Atkinson.
Near Fort Atkinson, 3 miles from Fort Atkinson on Black Hawk Island, which is not an island but a peninsula, where the Rock River flows into Lake Koshkonong. And she lived there all but 3 years of her life. So obviously she was rooted in Wisconsin. But I'm saying that her mind spanned other eras, other times. Mm. And she is as much a people poet as she is a poet of place, I think.
So she was born in 1903.
Correct.
In Wisconsin. Can you tell us about her parents and her childhood and sort of what early glimpses you got as her biographer that she was going to turn into a writer?
Well, you don't get many glimpses in the first 5, 6, 7 years. When she goes to school, one of her companions is a woman named Florence DeLossi, with whom I talked. And all you can deduce from Florence DeLossi is that Florence thought that Loreen was so impractical and so off in another world. And she said, how will she ever make her way in life? She's always dreaming. She's always, her mind is elsewhere. And you get the idea right there that this is an unusual child.
Well, she was, if not visually impaired, I guess, very nearsighted? Might that have contributed to her, what appeared to be her spaciness?
I think that did. Yes, she wore Coke bottle glass lenses from very early childhood, and she was really visually impaired.
She carried a magnifying glass, too.
She carried a magnifying glass in high school, and she was on the honor roll, but it took her 3 times as long to study because she read through a magnifying glass.
They say sometimes that a lot of great artists have pain in their background, suffering. It seems as if her parents were quite unusual people. Can you talk about them?
Yes, I can talk about her parents. Her parents were Henry Niedecker, who came from California when he was a very small child, and Teresa Coons. And they met when they were young, and they met in grade school and married in, I think it was 2 years before Loreen was born. You do the subtraction for me. That would be 1901, wouldn't it? Henry was an outgoing, inventive, freewheeling, experimental kind of man who ran businesses either well or very badly, who spent a lot of money, who made a lot of money, who talked a great deal, who gave a lot of parties. He alternated between being a fishing and hunting guide for money and being a carp seiner, which was extraordinarily hard work. Loreen loved her father. She was very, very close to him. And early photographs show the two of them in harmony much more than Loreen with her mother. The tragedy of Loreen's mother, and it was a tragedy, is that she became deaf very soon after Loreen's birth. And the deafness left her out of everything. She could not hear. She would sit with Loreen all night and not say anything, or she would pass a note. And then her husband became involved with another woman. And from then on, she became, I think Loreen would agree with this. I think Loreen said this. She became slightly deranged. I mean, she was not really quite right in her mind or her emotions.
Can you share one of the poems that Lorraine wrote about her parents?
About her parents?
Yeah, her mother, perhaps?
Yes, about her mother. Her poems about her mother are very poignant, very moving, and almost uniformly tragic. Here's one. Lorraine is speaking as the mother here, as Teresa Niedecker. What horror to awake at night and in the dimness see the light. Time is white, mosquitoes bite. I've spent my life on nothing. The thought that stings. How are you, nothing, sitting around with something's wife? Buzz and burn is all I learn. I've spent my life on nothing. I am pillowed and padded, pale and puffing, lifting household stuffing, carpets, dishes, benches, fishes. I've spent my life on nothing.
Kind of an unfulfilled housewife, I guess you'd have to say.
But, yes.
But with some extra issues on top of that.
With some extra issues on top of that. But one of the tragedies is that she and Henry were real pals at the beginning. And she helped him tar nets, and she helped him fish and row boats and patch boats. And she was a spirited, wonderful woman. And she became embittered and silent and, well, terribly embittered.
Sort of the curious thing was that Henry and the husband of the woman, the neighbor woman with whom he had the affair, apparently remained good friends. But not surprisingly, Lorraine's mother couldn't stand the other woman.
Lorraine's mother could not stand the other woman, and neither could Lorraine. And Lorraine, imagine the conflict in her, this father that she loved, and then seeing what he had done to her mother. It must have divided her so much.
There was even extra irony on top of that, I guess you could call it, in that the daughter born to Lorraine's father and the other woman was named Lorraine.
Lorraine, with an extra N.
With an extra R.
Yes.
Or double R. Double R.
You've got to wonder a little bit about that,
don't
you?
It's kind of strange.
Yes, and then there's the observation of a friend of Lorraine's who came to the island, Jerry Reisman, that Henry seemed to be sleeping with that daughter, perhaps.
Yeah, it gets very tangled.
It gets very tangled. It gets very tangled.
I noticed with the poem you read, this, and I noticed it with some of the other poems that you include within your biography, there's this kind of haunting mix of deep adult tragedy with kind of almost nursery rhymes, you know, the stuffing and the nothing and the this and the that. It's as if she is choosing verse form that belie the seriousness of the tragedy.
Yes, I think that's a very true point and a very interesting one. Her first book was called New Goose, and she intended the reference to Mother Goose rhymes. And her first poems in New Goose are very much short and Mother Goose-like, using these full of tension and emotion and feeling, and yet using the language of childhood, perhaps, rather than adulthood. But that's very true about this stuffing, the puffing. and the simple rhymes, the one-syllable rhymes that she... Well, they hit hard, those poems, I think.
So she's, even early on, I gather, she was emphasizing simplicity of language, short words, short lines.
Yes, and influenced very much by the objectivist movement of poetry, which officially announced itself in 1931 in Poetry Magazine, that was edited by Louis Sikofsky. And he, in not very simple language at all, stated that poetry should be simple, it should be musical, it should be concrete. There should be none of this poetic diction that the poets relied upon.
The Victorian and pre-Victorian kind of sound.
Yes, let's not go for the metaphors, the rhythms, the allusion, the rhymes, the obvious rhyming. Let's look at the object and describe it, and that will be truth.
Well, as she went into college, for example, though, was she still taken with say, the poetry of Wordsworth or even Byron and Coleridge?
Absolutely. Her book of On the Romantic Poets is one of the most thumbed in her library with the most notations on it. She's really learning from these poets, and at the same time she's saying to herself, I know that there's a different style. I know that this is dated. Beautiful as it is, there is something else, and I have to find something else.
And as she was in high school, before we get her off to Beloit College, she was in high school, what sort of tension did she feel between the sort of expectations for a young woman of her time and then this desire she had for an intellectual life, for a world of writing?
Well, in high school, I think I look at the photos of her, and she's always alone at the end of a row. You know, she's obviously feeling isolated. She had a few close friends, obviously. I think the difference between what was expected of women, with the example of her mother there, and her mother was an obsessive cleaner. I think her mother took out her frustration on cleaning the house. I mean, Lorene didn't want to clean houses. She didn't want to bake. She didn't want to sew. She knew that there was something. She had planned to be a teacher at the end of high school. I'm wondering if she was so completely out of it that she might have not felt all the pressures that the more ordinary people or more just normal young women of that time felt, because she was dreamy. I think maybe she didn't feel all those pressures to have to get married.
Did she feel
to go to college for your MRS degree? You know, I mean, she wasn't. I don't think she was aware of those things.
For your MRS degree, I've never heard it put that way. That's cute. Did she have? Okay, you say she wanted to become a teacher.
Well, she put that down in her application to Beloit College.
And how did she do at Beloit?
Well, she bombed her first semester, and then she got back together, and she started doing very well indeed.
And was she on any kind of a track at that point? I mean, it's, I guess, an assumption that going to college is somehow going to gear you toward a career, but if she's a dreamy poet, then which way would she go with that if she didn't become a teacher?
Well, she did dreadfully in economics. Dreadfully. And she was already writing poetry. She was writing poetry in college. She belonged to the college poetry society. She loved her English classes. I think you could see the way that she was going, even in her freshman and sophomore years, when most people don't know where they're going at all.
So she was getting poetry published in her college?
In a college.
Mm-hmm. Anthologies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in a college newspaper.
And what led to her withdrawal from Beloit College?
Well, it's debated very much so. I think I found the answer, real answer. It's always said that she had to come home and take care of her mother. But as I think I say in the biography, her mother was only 43 at the time. And although her mother was deaf by this time, fairly deaf, her mother was not physically handicapped in any way, I think. But then I discovered that her father, the year before, had opened up a club on Black Hawk Island, the Black Hawk Island Social Club. He had built it out of his own pocket, evidently counting on membership dues to pay him back. He had thrown a big party bash to inaugurate the club, all on his own money. Well, he didn't have a cent to send her to go to Beloit after that.
I wondered about that, so she just plain ran out of money.
I think he had no more money to send her at that point.
It was not something they necessarily wanted to talk about.
That's what I'm speculating.
So she has to get a job, or did she just go home and
she went home, and there she is with her Daisy, Teresa. Teresa was always called Daisy. Teresa, her mother, and Henry and his lover, and the future very, very bleak at that
point. What about her own love life at this point?
Well, it's fairly non-existent. She was admired by some boys in school. I talked to one of them, and other people have talked to the other, Ernest Hartwig. She became friends somehow with Ernest Hartwig's, who was in her class, his brother, Frank Hartwig, and they did marry very quietly.
How old was she at that point?
She was in her 20s. Her husband was 4 years older. Frank was 4 years older. He had dropped out of high school as a sophomore, he had dropped out of high school. He was a farmer. He loved to work outdoors.
Very handsome, by the one picture I've seen.
Very handsome man.
Doesn't look to have been a very long-lasting or successful marriage, however.
What, is it anywhere from one night to some slightly longer period of time?
Anywhere from one night to perhaps a year and a half, something like that, maybe 2 years. But it did not work emphatically. The Depression has a big role in this. Frank loses his construction business. He can't borrow any money. He's thrown out of work. He can't work. And the choice is for Loreen, do I become a farmer's wife or do I do something else?
She didn't much care for farming anyway, I gather.
Well, she was a water person. I don't think Holsteins and crops really interested her terribly much.
Well, so it's 1928, 1929. She's not going to be a farmer's wife.
No.
She has to support, if not her family, at least herself somehow at this point. Which way does she go?
Well, she gets a job as an assistant. An assistant librarian, not the assistant librarian, but just as an assistant at the Fort Atkinson Public Library. And you can imagine how low-paying that was. Mm-hmm. But she rather quickly makes her mark there because they let her write weekly columns of library news. And I think you can tell from the columns that she really is enjoying this. She's advising people what books to read and what books are new in the library.
And reading a few books herself.
Oh, yes. What a reader she was. And with that eyesight, baffles me about her, that a woman with this, she applied for disability at one point. Her eyesight was that bad from the government, disability from the government. And it amazes me how much she read. And then she would type all these notes from these books, pages and pages, hundreds of pages of notes, then make carbons and send them a carbon to Louis Zukofsky. Using her eyes just consistently and constantly, and then become a proofreader later on. The last thing she should have become was a proofreader. So, and I guess reading with a magnifying glass, right? And when she finally read aloud at the last in the last year of her life, her Sid McCorman, she did use a magnifying glass. She's looking at the page through a magnifying glass as she reads her poetry.
Well, we're going to follow the career of Loreen Niedecker, poet, when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest Margot Peters, who has written a biography about Loreen Niedecker called A Poet's Life, subtitled A Poet's Life. And we have been following the life and career of that Wisconsin poet in through the late 1920s through a marriage that by any accounts was a failure. And before we get into her connection with the greater literary world, how did she respond, did she respond for that matter, poetically to this experience of the failed marriage?
Yes, she did respond to the failed marriage in a poem that's unusual because it is not either in her surrealistic mode, and some of her early poems were very surrealistic and today I think still fairly incomprehensible, unless one just reads them for the sound and takes the sound out of them, which is what she meant, and the associations with those sounds. But this expresses, I think, her despair after the breakup of her marriage and after she was fired from the Fort Atkinson Library, and she had to go home to her parents, and with no income, had to rely on her father again.
Why was she fired, by the way?
It was a depression. Mm-hmm. And they were laying off, and they hired a new person with a degree from the East. And
I see. Wanted to make sure it wasn't because they discovered her poems like they did with Walt Whitman at his job.
Writing them on the back of those catalog cards.
No, not at all. No, not like Walt Whitman. No, she was fired a few days before Christmas, and simply economics. She had to be let go. The situation is quite rather similar to today.
I was going to say, it did sound familiar.
Yeah, it's familiar.
And so, but she did write a poem, and what did she do with this poem, by the way?
She sent it out to be published, and it was published. It's called When Ecstasy is Inconvenient, and that's a good example of her irony, her playing with words. Feign a great calm, all gay transport soon ends. Chant, who knows, flight's end or flight's beginning for the resting gull. Heart, be still. Say there is money, but it rusted. Say the time of moon is not right for escape. It's the color in the lower sky, too broadly suffused, or the wind in my tie. Know amazedly how often one takes his madness into his own hands and keeps it.
There's a loneliness in that, about sort of keeping your own madness, isn't there?
And despair.
Yes, and maybe even a little bit of repulsion, if not downright horror.
Yes.
Does she ever write a more straightforward confessional poem where she uses the I voice and says, you know, my husband this? Or, I mean, does she ever write in a kind of direct personal confessional voice?
She does. But one thing she says is very important. She says, I'm a different character in every poem I write. So it's not just, she's not a confessional poet, or very seldom. Let's put it that way. This poem was confessional. When ecstasy is inconvenient, that is confessional.
But it's oblique and
it's
indirect.
It's oblique, yes.
But she does take on these, I guess,
personas. Yes, and
personas.
She says, no, amazedly often one takes his madness into his own hands. She doesn't say my hands, my own hands. So she, again, she's being oblique.
I sort of had the vague notion she was referring to her husband when she referred to his and his madness. But I guess that's open to interpretation.
I think that's open to interpretation.
How does she then finally connect to anyone else? I mean, if she's not, her job has failed, her marriage has failed.
Correct.
But her heart all along is in her words anyway.
Yes.
How does she finally get a lifeline?
Well, she goes to the Fort Atkinson Library and reads the latest issue of the February 1931 issue of Poetry Magazine, and it is edited by Louis Zukofsky, a poet from New York. And he states the Objectivist Creed, and he gathers together for publication in that issue a group of poets that he considers to be objectivist, at least in part, as examples of objectivism. And Lorene read that and said, this is the center. I feel now that objectivism is the center of literature, not only in the United States, but in the world. And this changed her life, I think. And then she ratcheted up the nerve to write to Louis Zukofsky, and he answered, and they began a correspondence, which ended in her going to New York at least six times to visit him. So finally she is connected with a poet. He introduces her to other poets. She met William Carlos Williams. She met Charles Reznikov, George Oppen. These are all objectivist poets.
What are the tenets, then, of objectivism? I think of it as meaning that the poem in itself doesn't have to point to something else, but it is something in its own right, but I'm not sure how far that gets us.
No, I think that that's true. Zukofsky says, look at the object, describe the object faithfully, and you will have a poem if you are faithful to it. And he also, influenced by Pound, who said, look into your ear and write. Zukofsky also emphasized the music, and he constantly in his correspondence with Lorene emphasized music, music. Hear what you're saying, right?
You mentioned a collection called New Goose. Is that written after she's had this contact
with
the objectivist?
Yes.
And how does sort of going to Mother Goose relate to objectivism?
Well, because the rhymes are short and crisp, and I shouldn't say rhymes, the poems are short, crisp, and objective. The vocabulary is simple, and they also are, and she's now politically subversive through her association with Zukofsky and simply through the Depression itself. She's turned into a leftist, although she was never an ideologue, really. And although she distributed communist leaflets in Madison, she soon tired of distributing communist leaflets in Madison and went back to poetry. Her New Goose is also a deliberate trying to get away from the surreal, because what Harriet Monroe, who was the editor of Poetry, did mainly was turn down her poetry. She just said, Lorene, I can't understand this. I just don't know what you're talking about. And Lorene wants to be published. She desperately wants to be published. So objectivism gives her that kind of ladder, so to speak, to climb out of dream and get into reality.
Do you have some samples from New Goose of the kind of writing she was doing?
This is typical New Goose. Apples are high. That shows they're scarce. Still, the stores always seem to have plenty. Can't get a price, the farmers say. I guess it's because there are too many. And this has that simple Mother Goose rhyming scheme. It's also a protest poem.
Okay, now how... Oh, I see, with the scarcity and the price and everything. There's economics there.
Yes, she's... New Goose is rooted in economics.
And also sympathy for the farmer, too,
which was, of course,
a big issue in the Depression, the Dust Bowl and all of that.
Absolutely.
It also seems she's writing with some... I know you said she was upset about being filed as a regional writer, but on the other hand, it does show a sense of place. It's something you can imagine someone from Wisconsin writing.
I don't argue that. I would just point out that at the same time, she's writing about Southern sharecroppers as well, and she's writing about Van Gogh, who is an artist who was starving in the dunes at that time, couldn't get paid for his work. I mean, she is Wisconsin, but her mind is ranging all over the territory.
Does she write any poems that are sort of directly political, very obviously, almost like propaganda?
She did a few of those, and then she just she decided almost immediately that if you can't make propaganda into poetry, into music, into magic, and magic was a big word in her vocabulary. She thought poetry was magic in a way, plain speech turned into some kind of magic. Then it was no good as poetry, and she soon abandoned any kind of direct proletarian political poetry.
Did she, we mentioned at the beginning the Chinese and Japanese comparison, if not the influence. Did she write in any other verse forms, haiku, for example?
She certainly read haiku, and her favorite poet was Basho, and she felt very close to him and his work. Li Po, she also read. She can admit sometimes, she says, Japanese poems are all the same. They're all about autumn and sadness and leaves falling. I just can't take any more of this.
Sadness? Well, she could have responded to that.
Yes. But she adopted a stanza that she liked and used it quite often. It's a five-line stanza, and I'd like to just read a few of those very brief ones. They're not, you can see how unlike Japanese poetry haiku they are, and yet how like, in a sense. My friend tree, I sawed you down, but I must attend an older friend, the sun. And she uses rhyming of the...
Attend and friend.
The third and fourth lines, and she liked that form very much. Another one of those, a popcorn can cover screwed to the wall over a hole so the cold can't mouse in.
And what were reviewers and critics doing with her work? And did she mind when unkind things were said?
Very few unkind things were ever said about Lorene's poetry during her lifetime. She was appreciated very much by other poets. Her problem was that she was published by very small presses, in editions of 100 or 200. And she was published in very esoteric poetry magazines with circulations of 100 souls. So, she's not being published by Norton, by Knopf, by Simon & Schuster. She is being published very obscurely, and poets know her, but it's going to be very hard for the public to get to know this poet.
And what did her association with Louis Zukovsky, this, I'm not even sure exactly what to call him other than a kind of a poet, ideologue, and I guess you'd have to call him a critic too in the sense that he's defining objectivism in poetry. What did that relationship bring her?
Well, it brought her a lifeline to another poet and through Zukovsky to other poets because he read her work to other poets and he recommended her work to other poets. Curiously enough, later in her career, he would never write her a blurb or a review.
He would never?
No. He always refused.
And then they did have a relationship beyond poetry, I gather, too.
They had a relationship beyond poetry, definitely. They were lovers for a time.
And it sounds as if he brought her a lot of heartbreak.
He brought her a lot of heartbreak. But I think what he brought, the friendship that he brought her, outweighed in the long run the heartbreak. And there's a moment after they break up as, terrible modern phrase, but anyway, break up as lovers. And he says, "You're going underground, aren't you, Lorene? Don't leave. I know you're going to withdraw now from my life," because he then married another woman. And she has to make this decision. Do I stay with him? Do I retain my faith in him as a poet, even though he has perhaps broken my heart as a man? And she does, and she becomes a friend. She tries to make a friend of his wife, too. That was rather
tough assignment.
Tough assignment, rather superficial.
Because she actually did have, she was impregnated by Zhukovsky.
Yes.
About
yes.
this time.
Yes.
And that was another tough decision of hers, I gather, as to how to respond to that.
Well, yes. She did not want an abortion, and Zhukovsky insisted upon it. And that was a source of deep sorrow for her and trauma.
Did that affect her poetry, do you think? Or do we see that directly or indirectly coming through?
I've searched her poetry with a fine-tooth comb. I've pulled out a few poems that might reflect what went on. But as I said before, she's not a confessional poet. Her poem about Mary Shelley, who lost one child, then two, I think that reflects mm-hmm. that experience with Zhukovsky. But there are very few poems that you could just point and say, this talks about what I went through in New York. You know, she's not doing that.
You write in your book, too, about her dedication of a book of poetry to the son of Zhukovsky by this other woman, which, again, seems one of those sort of tangled relationships
very
that
tangled.
She had in her childhood as well.
Very tangled. And her her fascination with and interest in the son of Louis and Celia Zhukovsky really obsessed her for many years. She wrote a book, and it was called For Paul. It was never published that way because Zhukovsky wouldn't let it be. And Paul himself would not accept a dedication to Paul.
Well, that gets tough.
Yes, yes.
Have your dedication rejected?
Yes, your dedication is rejected by the person that you adore.
Do you think that she would be more well-known now and would have been published more readily had she been more aggressive, more assertive as a person?
I'm sure she would have been. I think that is absolutely true. But Lorene is militantly reclusive, militantly against publicizing herself.
And she wouldn't do readings either, would she?
Never do readings.
Well, with a magnifying glass, it'd be hard. But, of course, she if she were like, you know, say, Robert Frost, she would be able to recite them. You kind of wonder if she could recite her poems without having to read them.
She could have done that. Of
but
course, she could have. She could have done that.
Aspect of it,
but
that, seems to be averse to her.
Exactly, and she says, and I think this is in self-defense. She says a poem has to come out of a silence to a reader, and enter his mind, her mind in silence.
Do you think her mother's deafness led her to gravitate toward a world of silence herself or isolation?
That's an interesting question. I had really thought that maybe it stimulated her to do what she did, you know, because she did send her work out to be published. She was militant about getting it published. She didn't want to read it. And, of course, reading was comparative, wasn't it? Reading poetry, didn't that become big in the 60s and the 70s?
Sure. Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's when it really became a huge thing for poets to go around doing readings to thousands on campuses. And,
to that scale, yeah, sure.
You know, Robert Lowell and Ginsberg and people like that attracting huge crowds with poetry. And she was not a Billy Collins, may we add.
The picture that you have on the cover of your biography shows her sort of, I think it's the high school graduation picture, but it shows her gazing into the distance in a kind of dreamy way, and you almost have the sense that she's in her own world.
That's because she couldn't see. She took her glasses off most of the pictures, didn't she?
Norman,
sorry.
Stop bringing this down to ocultism.
There's a practical reason behind some things.
Yes, there is. Yes, she does tend to gaze dreamily. out of her photographs. But I think she has an inward. I think it kept her alive. Her inward world kept her absolutely alive and going.
Did she see herself as a kind of successor to Emily Dickinson or any other of the sort of women writers that came before her, the Brontes, for example, or others that kind of had a literary world of their own?
She doesn't speak much about that at all, but we have to remember that she kept journals, and she, before her death, asked that they all be destroyed. This is the kind of thing that would have been in the journals. So those journals do not exist. She said one thing about the Brontes. She said, the Brontes have their moors, I have my marshes. Period. I, however, have written an article about Charlotte Bronte and Loreen because they remind me so much of each other. I think they're so similar in so many ways. But Emily Dickinson, somebody told her, William Carlos Williams, I believe, told her that she was like Emily Dickinson, only better. She was a modern Emily Dickinson, only better. She didn't think of that herself.
But in a way, I mean, the comparison, I mean, I guess comparisons can be pretty easy, can be pretty superficial too. But in terms of the shortness of the lines, the sort of epigrammatic quality of the verses, and then the fact that she was to a great extent isolated and that these poems didn't get out to many, many people during her lifetime. There are some similarities there.
There are some similarities there, and that Emily Dickinson really wasn't known until 49 years after her death, for example. And Niedecker, well, it's not been that long, but I mean, Niedecker is really now in the last 10 or 15 years, I think, coming into
40 years, 25 or more years after her death.
Yes.
We're going to sample some more of the poems of Loreen Niedecker and talk about the end of her life when we continue in a moment with University of the Air. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Margot Peters, and we are talking about her biography of Loreen Niedecker, a Wisconsin poet who became known for her modernist, objectivist poetry and sort of avant-garde work, although her work has been eclipsed by others who kind of aggressively sought the limelight a little more than she did. Would you say that her origins near Fort Atkinson on Black Hawk Island have a way of showing up in her poetry now and then?
Certainly they do. I emphasized before that her mind ranged everywhere and she wrote about many, many subjects, but Black Hawk Island is absolutely basic to them, and there are many, many poems. Perhaps her best-known one is Paean to Place. Of course, paean means a hymn of thanksgiving, of praise, and she is looking back and saying, this place made me, Black Hawk Island, the Rock River, my life by water made me. Paean to Place. Fish, fowl, flood, water lily, mud, my life in the leaves and on water. My mother and I born in swale and swamp and sworn to water. My father through marsh fog, sculled down from high ground, saw her face at the Oregon, bore the weight of lake water and the cold. He seined for carp to be sold, that their daughter might go high on land to learn. Saw his wife turn deaf and away, she who knew boats and ropes no longer played. So beginning there with a tribute to both mother and father.
Mm-hmm. And that sense of Wisconsin, too, in this
case.
That
is Wisconsin, absolutely.
And the idea that her father sort of sacrificed so that she could go to school, go on to a different kind of life.
Yes. I just counted the mentions of her mother and father and herself in this poem, and they're all equal, I think, about 12, 12, 12.
You got them equal time.
Yes.
That looks to be a longer poem than would be typical for some of hers.
Very much longer than is typical. It's in length, more like her later poems, like Lake Superior and Wintergreen Ridge and Darwin. But this does not feel like those later poems at all. Can I read just a few more things that I like here? I love this. Dancing grounds my people had none. Woodcocks had, backland, air around. Solemnities such as what flower to take to grandfather's grave, unless water lilies. He who'd bowed his head to grass as he mowed, iris now grows on Phil. For the two and for him where they lie, how much less am I in the dark than they? And then probably one of the most famous stanzas here. I was the solitary plover, a pencil for a wingbone. From the secret notes I must tilt upon the pressure, execute and adjust. In us, sea air rhythm, we live by the urgent wave of the verse. And so it's personal. It's about her family. It's a tribute to her family and what...
And it's also about her writing.
About her writing, yes.
So she leaves New York while she goes back and forth, I gather, half a dozen times altogether, largely to see Louis Zukovsky and, I guess, reconnect with the circle of poets in particular there. But essentially, Lorene Nitteker spends the rest of her life in Wisconsin.
Essentially, she does, yes.
And has to take menial work.
And takes menial work, proofreading and scrubbing hospital floors. She worked in the dietary unit of the Fort Atkinson Hospital as a cleaning woman.
Is she writing poems, though, and stuffing them in drawers, writing poems and sending them out to get published? You said she really wanted to get published.
She's writing poems and sending them out to be published.
And how was her luck?
Very good. But so as I say, these tiny magazines, you know, they don't have many readers. But she's getting a reputation, and she becomes known in England through the propaganda work, really, of Jonathan Williams, who published her. He owned the Jargon Society Press and admired her greatly and published her and then went to England and talked with poets over there, and she began to be published in England. She had two books published in England.
But she's still battling poverty, right?
And still battling poverty, yes.
Is that partly why she decides to marry again?
I think it's a very basic reason why she does. She really wants to get married because she wants somebody to support her so she can write.
Really. How does that work out?
The second marriage? The second marriage worked out quite well. Sid Corman, who was her friend and who knew her, said they never could have done it when they were both young, but they tolerate each other very well.
How old is she at this point?
I knew you'd ask me that, Norman.
You saw me coming.
Yes. All right. They married in 1963.
Oh, so she's 60.
She's 60 years old. Yes.
It seems to me she does write about that second marriage as well, and it sounds as if her second husband was an alcoholic.
He was an alcoholic. His daughter says that he was a functioning alcoholic. And there are quite a few poems about his alcoholism, which she really, which distressed her greatly at the beginning of the marriage. She read books on alcoholism. She read The Lost Weekend. She tried to figure out where she was with this man. In fact, as an alcoholic, he was not an abusive person to her, which I think saved it. So here's one. She's thinking about her marriage to Albert Millen, who is an industrial painter from Milwaukee. She met him when he came up to buy a retirement cottage on Blackhawk Island, and he applied to her because she had houses to rent. I married in the world's black night for warmth, if not repose. At the close, someone. I hid with him from the long-range guns. We lay leg in the cupboard, head in closet. A slit of light at no bird dawn. Untaught, I thought, he drank too much. I say I married and lived unburied. I thought.
What does that mean? It sounds like a very small apartment, but that's presumably not the case. Head in, leg in cupboard, head in closet. How do you?
It was a very small apartment.
Oh, it was. All right. That may well be what she
was
referring
to. Sounds as if she felt trapped in some ways.
You know, it does sound that way. But also, Al Millen gave her so much. She never drove because she couldn't see, not well enough to drive, to get a license. And he started taking her places. And this inspires much of the poetry from 1963 to 1970, because he is taking her to the Black Hills and to around Lake Superior on that Circle route, and to Door County. So she owes a great deal, and her poetry expanded because of him and that influence. And also he was a companion. He was there. And as she says, he knows who Bertrand Russell is.
Probably her first husband didn't.
No.
So how does the second husband figure in the poetry? Just by dint of enabling her to be inspired in general? Or does he actually continue to figure in the poetry in his own right as some kind of
He figures unnamed always in the poetry in his own right. She does write about six poems about brooding about the alcoholism. But she contrasts him with a man that she was in love with before she met Al Millen and who did not wish to marry her, and which was a heartbreak for her. And she says, she compares the two, and she says, this man, Al Millen, she said, he's the one that falls in the water and presses his wet paycheck dry between the leaves of Walt Whitman. And then she says, he's the man for me.
And was he aware of her poetry, or did she kind of hide that a bit?
She didn't tell him before the wedding, and after the wedding she said, I'm a poet. And he said, what?
Could have been a deal breaker. How did she then become, I'm not even sure whether she used the word discovered or rediscovered, late in life as a poet?
Late in life, in her life, in her lifetime. Well, through the efforts, I think, largely of Jonathan Williams. He published a first collected Loreen Niedecker, and it got her the first review in the New York Times. And it was very well reviewed. Two books, I think, The Granite Pail and TNG, which stands for Tenderness and Gristle. That's a quote from Lawrence Durrell. That book, collected, said, here is a poet that we must take seriously. And the New York Times put its imprimatur on it, and I think that made a big difference.
You have to wonder a little bit how fame would have affected her. I mean, had she been around much longer than that?
Well, you know, I've just finished the letters of Elizabeth Bishop, and I cannot help contrasting Loreen Niedecker and Elizabeth Bishop. Elizabeth Bishop got every grant and scholarship mm-hmm. under the sun. And why? She was out east. Robert Lowell was her closest friend.
Connections.
Yeah.
She had money. It dried up after a while, but she had money from her grandmother. She could travel freely. She knew everybody in the poetry circle. And grant after grant after grant, and scholarship after scholarship after scholarship. And it's just the opposite, the total opposite of Loreen Niedecker.
But running through her poetry is perhaps that sense of, I don't know, the isolation and the pain.
Oh, it's poignant.
That's there, and yes. That's maybe the most haunting part of
it's
her.
Her isolation is the most haunting part of her, I think. Yes.
Well, thank you for taking us through the life and some of the poetry, a little bit of the poetry of Loreen Niedecker, not a regional poet by any means, but a Wisconsin poet who wrote on much broader issues most of the time. Our guest has been Margot Peters. Thanks for the hour.
And congratulations on your new book.
Well, thank you so much, Emily and Norman.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you can join us for the next hour of University of the Air.